Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masterson. Today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with a landmark passage today in the UN General Assembly of the Arms Trade Treaty, the first international treaty regulating the multi-billion dollar global arms trade. Louis Bellinger, the spokesperson for ControlArms.org, a coalition of activists who campaigned for a bulletproof treaty, joins us to discuss the treaty that Syria, Iran, and North Korea tried to block and how it will be implemented. Then we will speak with public health lawyer Michelle Simon, the president of Eat Drink Politics, about what is derisively being referred to as the Monsanto Protection Act, a rider inserted by Monsanto's lobbyists in the recent must-pass continuing resolution that requires the Department of Agriculture to ignore any court ruling that would halt the planting of genetically engineered crops. We will discuss how the Senate and the President folded and Michelle Simon's article at Food Safety News, Monsanto teams up with Congress to shred the Constitution. Then finally, we will speak with Damon Moglend, the Climate and Energy Program Director at Friends of the Earth, about the rivers of oil flowing through the streets of the town of Mayflower, Arkansas. We will discuss the impact of the spill of thousands of barrels of heavy Canadian tar sands crude oil from an Exxon pipeline built in the 1940s, and how this will affect the national debate on the Keystone XL pipeline that will carry the same oil across the U.S. from Canada to Texas. And joining us now is Louis Bellinger, who is the spokesperson for ControlArms.org, a coalition of activists who have campaigned for a bulletproof UN arms trade treaty. He's also the spokesperson for Oxfam International and was Oxfam International spokesperson in Washington, D.C. and Brussels for the last 4 years. Previously, he worked for the International Trade Union Confederation and for the World Wildlife Federation. Welcome to Background Briefing, Louis Bellinger.
Thank you very much.
And I take it you're celebrating, and I don't want to keep you for too long because you've been working very hard to get the United Nations to pass this treaty on the arms trade treaty, and it's not been without some setbacks. A few days ago, Syria, Iran, and North Korea blocked the treaty by consensus, but it passed today 154 votes to 3 with 23 abstentions. So I take it you're feeling good.
Yes, we're feeling great. This was a good day. You know, there's a lot of bashing on the United Nations in terms of the type of organization and the type of efficiency that we've been seeing in the last years or so. But today was a good day. I think today governments, with the help of the Control Arms Coalition and all the campaigners who have campaigned for this arms trade treaty, I think we made the world a safer place today, and we can be proud of what was done. And there was quite a lot of emotion in the room. And like you said, we had quite a few setbacks over the years. And just last Thursday, those three countries just blocked the consensus. And today it was just a tsunami of support. The majority sent a clear message to the world that they want more regulation between countries. They want weapons to be put under tight control. And I want to emphasize that this is about the transfer, the international transfer of weapons and ammunition between countries. It has nothing to do with domestic ownership. It has nothing to do with right here in the United States or elsewhere. It has to do with international transfers between countries. So, yes, today is a good day, and I think we can be proud of ourselves.
And these international transfers of arms between countries are a trade worth $70 billion annually. That's not small change.
Yes, no, it's a huge business. And, you know, just for your listeners to understand, there is currently no international treaty that regulates the arms trade. What does that mean? It means, well, we have treaties that regulate clothes, that regulates meat, that regulates flat-screen TVs and iPod, but there's no international treaty between countries on how to say to countries, this is how you should behave on the international scene. This is, you know, these are the rules when you trade dangerous AK-47, M-16, round of ammunition, tanks, attack helicopter. These are the rules by which you should behave under. And right now we have this rule. We have this international norm that will say to the country, you can no longer act with impunity. You can no longer do whatever you want to do and sell weapons left and right to dictators and arms dealers. You have to respect certain rules.
And we're talking about the kind of arms that this new treaty covers are battle tanks, armored combat vehicles, large caliber artillery systems, combat aircraft, attack helicopters, warships, missiles and missile launchers, small arms and light weapons. And ammunition, is that also covered?
Yes, it is covered.
And what is the trade in ammunition? It's extraordinary, isn't it, how many bullets are sold per year?
Yes, I mean, there are two bullets produced every year per person on this planet. Over 12 billion bullets are being produced and sold every single year, enough to kill everyone on the planet twice. So, you know, when we say we need regulation, we need to know where these millions of rounds of ammunition are going and who is using them. I think it's an understatement. So, you know, you said today, are you celebrating? How are you feeling? For me, I personally, you know, and I think everyone in Oxfam and in the Control Arms Coalition shares that views. Today is not really about us. Today is about the millions of victims of armed violence and the innocent victims of the unregulated trade who have lost their lives, who have, you know, been injured by armed violence. And we had quite a few here, people who have lost. We had a colleague from Scotland who had lost his son on a holiday in Turkey because of the illegal trade in weapons. We had a colleague from Guatemala who was on a wheelchair because of that. So, you know, this is very real for us. And for me, my heart goes out to all these people who have suffered from armed violence.
So, again, I'm speaking with Louis Bélanger, who is the spokesperson for ControlArms.org, a coalition of activists who have campaigned for a bulletproof UN arms trade treaty, which was just passed today. He's also the spokesperson for Oxfam International. Now, the hiccups last Thursday, the Syria and Iran and North Korea tried to block the treaty. So you didn't get it by consensus. It was a vote, and there were 23 abstentions led by Russia and China, Cuba, Venezuela, Bolivia, Nicaragua, etc., all abstained. Give me a sense then, even though it was passed by a substantial majority, 154-3 with 23 abstentions, what is the enforcement mechanism? Is this a moral enforcement mechanism, or is there an actual teeth in this treaty?
Yeah, these are good questions. Basically, just to come back on what happened last Thursday, where we wanted the treaty, well, the chair wanted the treaty to be adopted under consensus. Consensus means everyone has to agree. So you had 190 countries which were fine with the treaty as it was to go ahead, and there were three countries, and you named them, Syria, Iran, and North Korea, who blocked this treaty for everybody else. So they pushed the treaty to today, and today we had a treaty and to be voted under simple majority. We needed 97. We got 155. It has changed because Angola, a small country in Africa, changed their vote. They said they made a mistake. So it's 155 countries in favor. So what does that mean? To answer your question, you know, how will this treaty be implemented? First, people need to sign it. Countries need to go and sign the treaty and agree to it. Second, they need to ratify it by their Congress, Parliament, whatever works out, you know, whatever institution they have back home. Once 50 countries have ratified the treaty, 10 days later, it comes into place. But what's, you know, important to remember is that today sends a clear message. Today sends a message that you can no longer act in complete impunity. There is an international treaty that 155 countries have voted yes on, and this becomes international law. And, you know, I think in the last couple of months, you've heard Russia saying, well, you know, we're not breaking the law. We're providing weapons to Syria. We're providing weapons to a regime which we believe respect human rights. And we're not breaking any law, so we're going to keep on going. Well, right now, they are breaking the law.
And does that mean then that Russia is going to be answerable, literally, starting today?
Well, you know, if I mean, I've said that a few times to some of your colleagues. Like, if a country wants to keep on selling weapons for the next 25 years to North Korea and Iran, they can do that. I mean, nothing stops them, but there's a cost and there's a price at the international level for doing that. The same way there's a cost if someone doesn't join a certain treaty, for example, the Kyoto, protocol, or if there's a cost if someone doesn't sign the landmine treaty and keeps on producing landmines and selling them all over the world. But, you know, there's a price for this. So, mm-hmm. You know, the point of what your listeners should understand is that, you know, if you keep on breaking this treaty, well, first of all, people will stop selling weapons to you, and there is a price at the international level that you will pay. So, you know, we believe that in the long term, this will reduce armed violence. This will reduce the number of people that are killed because of the irresponsible arms trade, and we believe it will make a difference.
And Louis Bellinger, it seems like your organization, ControlArms.org, the coalition of activists who campaign for this bulletproof UN arms trade treaty that was just passed today, some of your tactics were quite imaginative. It seems that it did get the attention of the UN delegations. You had a mock-up of an attack helicopter on a roof opposite the UN, and then the choirs were singing to the representatives of the General Assembly of the United Nations as they went in, and also you were handing out cookies shaped like bullets. So give us a sense of the theater.
What theater? You know, I mean, it's great. I'm glad you're asking this. I mean, our role as activists is just to keep telling delegates, we're watching you. You know, you're not just in a room at the UN somewhere lost in Midtown West in Manhattan, you know, Midtown East, Manhattan. We're watching you, and delegation, coalition, and campaigners, excuse me, from all over the world are watching you. And, you know, this is what we did. We try to get a bit of media attention to it. We try to get delegates to be reminded every day that they were being, that we supported them as well, because there's a lot of that, you know, there was a lot of opposition and it was a difficult treaty to negotiate. So, you know, you mentioned the choir. We had a nice choir from Harlem that, you know, welcomed the delegates and singing a couple of songs by Elvis and whatnot. And it just put a smile on their face. It gives them energy. And today was a culmination of that. And you know, you had to be there to believe it. And I saw African delegates, you know, tearing up, because this will make a difference, in Africa. This will be a treaty that saves lives. And, you know, there was a lot of emotion in the room. And, it was a great 2 weeks.
Well, apparently, already here in the United States, the National Rifle Association, the largest pro-gun lobby here in the United States, who incidentally today released a report on arguing that they should have armed guards at schools in this country, they have said that they would fight the implementation of this treaty in the Senate. And the Secretary of State, John Kerry, has also described this treaty as strong, effective, and implementable. So what's your understanding of the next step here in terms of the United States ratifying the treaty? I mean, there's no question that the White House will sign it, but will the Senate pass it?
Yeah, so I think there's a campaign in the U.S. that needs to start now. But one, you know, to make sure that the president signed the treaty and support it. And second, I think from both the civil society side, so both for campaigners, but also from the administration and Democrats and everybody else that support a treaty, to make things clear, you know, to give a clear picture to the American public, to say this is a treaty about international transfers of weapons. It has absolutely nothing to do with domestic ownership. You know, there's not like a UN inspector that's going to go and inspect how weapons are being bought in the States and how American citizens are behaving with those guns. You know, it's not going to happen. This is not what the treaty is about. The treaty is about the transfer from the United States of America to another country, or from Canada to another country. This is what the treaty is about. So, you know, I mean, the NRA can say all they want that this, infringed the Second Amendment rights of Americans, but it's just not true. It's just lies. And if the NRA wants to continue to side. Look who blocked the treaty. The three countries that blocked the treaty that was against having more regulation on the arms trade was Syria, the Republic of Iran, and North Korea. So the NRA can side with those three countries all they want. You know, they know they're telling lies.
Well, but on the other hand, the countries that make the weapons, not sell the weapons, or refuse to sign the treaty, which you just mentioned, the three outliers, Syria, Iran, and North Korea. But in terms of the top 10 arms suppliers in the world, this is figures from 2012, the United States is the top arms supplier in the world with $8.8 billion in trade. Russia's second with $8 billion. China's third with $1.8 billion. Ukraine is fourth with $1.3 billion. Germany fifth with $1.2 billion. France sixth with $1.1 billion. UK seventh with $0.9 billion. And then Italy with $0.8 billion. And Netherlands with 7.7 billion and Spain with 0.7. So Russia abstained and China abstained, but most of the arms producers on this list, the top 10 arms producers, signed the treaty. So are they really prepared to lose the business?
Well, it's not about losing the business. This is actually a very good question, because people say, you know, what is in for the United States or France or the UK or Germany to sell weapons? I mean, it's not in their interest right now to sell weapons to Iran, to Syria, or to any government that we know are going to go ahead and infringe human rights. I mean, I don't think that it's in any of those countries' interest. And the majority of countries, and even, you know, sort of the most skeptics of countries, want more regulation. You know, there's a real clear need for the world to be under tighter regulation. Now, you know, if Russia and China do not come through, I don't think it means that the U.S. is losing business. It means that that's the decision of China and Russia, but, you know, they will have they still will need to act accordingly. They still, you know, their behavior will be followed. Because we now have a norm, and this is what the treaty, and I think that's what your listeners need to understand. What do treaty do? You know, what does a treaty do? A treaty establishes an international norm on how you should behave. I want to sell weapons to you. Well, there should be some rules. There should be some rules to ensure that you're not going to use them against your own people. There should be some rules to make sure that you're not going to go and violate international humanitarian law and do all kinds of nonsense. So, you know, that's what it does. And we're confident if we have many countries that will sign on to the treaty, that will ratify it, that will come into force in, you know, within the next 5 years, that it will make a difference. And, you know, all ducks in a row, people will fall in line. And I gave the example earlier to the landmine treaty where the United States did not sign, did not ratify, did not support the landmine treaty. And look what happened. They've stopped producing them, they've stopped selling them, and the last decade, you haven't seen a landmine in the market because, you know, it establishes a norm, it establishes sort of some sort of authority, and that's what we're looking for to do with the arms trade treaty.
Well, you mentioned, Louis Bélanger, Russia from now on, because this treaty has been passed the United Nations, if it sells arms to Syria, it's in violation of the treaty, even though the Russians abstained from the vote. What about those that want to sell arms or even give arms to the Syrian rebels? How are they covered by this treaty?
Well, if you want to sell weapons tomorrow to the Syrian rebel, you would need to make the same assessment. You know, this treaty applies to non-state actor as well as governments. So if tomorrow France or Italy or the U.S. want to sell weapons to the rebel, they need to make sure that these, you know, the weapons will not fall in the wrong hands. So I think anybody that will make an assessment today to say, can I guarantee that the weapons that I sell to the rebels will not be used to violate human rights or international humanitarian law or sort of a list of things, of criteria that you need to go through that's in the treaty today, anybody that make that assessment on the risk will come to the conclusion that, yes, there is a risk, and we believe should not go ahead with the transfer.
Well, just in closing, Louis Bélanger, you, of course, the spokesperson for the ControlArms.org, which is the coalition of activists, but within the coalition, you're also the spokesperson for Oxfam International and also Amnesty International were involved in the coalition and pushing the treaty. So these are the humanitarian groups that normally feed people. So what's the connection between the humanitarian groups that are trying to save lives from disease and famine and getting involved in this arms trade treaty?
It's a great question. And the answer is conflict is one of the main drivers of poverty. And, you know, I've traveled in several places and especially in Africa, and you could tell the impact and the negative impact that the unregulated arms trade is having in Africa. I was in Goma in the Democratic Republic of Congo just a month ago, and you see the impact that weapons is having on the lives of people. You see that people cannot lift themselves out of poverty because they are always stuck in conflict, because they flee violence and they are under constant threat of attack, and this cannot go on. So, you know, why is Oxfam, a development and humanitarian NGO, working in arms trade? And the simple answer is because conflict is one of the main drivers of poverty, and we believe that if there's less violence, if there's less weapons, if there's less ammunition that are fueling these conflict, you know, people can move forward, that we can make Africa and other places in the world a little safer and a little you know, better and ready for serious development. So that's why Oxfam has been working so hard in the last decade to reach this arms trade treaty.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Louis Bélanger.
Thank you for your interest.
Again, I've been speaking with Louis Bélanger, who is the spokesperson for ControlArms.org, a coalition of activists who have campaigned for a bulletproof UN arms trade treaty that was just passed today. He's also the spokesperson for Oxfam International, and he has previously worked for the International Trade Union Confederation and the World Wildlife Federation. And we're going to take a brief station break and be back talking about how the White House and the Senate caved for what's being called the Monsanto Protection Act.
Come, you masters of war. You that build the big guns. You that build the death planes. You that build all the bombs. You that hide behind walls. You that hide behind disks.
I just don't want. Tomatoes that won't rot, drop resistant grain.
You could do by adding or deleting DNA. The species that you use don't even have to be the same. It's strange that people panic when they hear the fish genes are added to strawberries to help them not to freeze.
But can GMOs help with the crisis mounting? It's a challenge to feed 7 billion and counting. Droughts and food prices are causing world hunger. So what's the big deal if we make the crop stronger?
But with GMOs, you can patent the breeds and sue the farmers if they replant the seeds. The ideas to help developing nations, but who benefits? Communities and corporations.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Michelle Simon, who's a public health lawyer specializing in legal strategies to counter corporate tactics. She is president of Eat Drink Politics, a corporate watchdog consulting firm, and is the author of Appetite for Profit, How the Food Industry Undermines Our Health and How to Fight Back. Her latest article at Food Safety News and the Huffington Post is Monsanto Teams Up with Congress to Shred the Constitution. Welcome to Background Briefing, Michelle Simon.
Thanks for having me.
And tell us how Monsanto has shredded the Constitution, Monsanto being a giant food manufacturing and processing organization famous for genetically modified seeds that propagates around the world. And I guess it's also famous for its litigious muscle, but what happened on Congress, and why did the president sign this bill that is being derisively called the Monsanto Protection Act?
Mm-hmm. Well, what happened was, you know, we had a ridiculous emergency situation where Congress had to pass the budget bill, which was called the Continuing Resolution, and the president had to sign it by the deadline or the government was going to shut down. So in that kind of crisis moment, no good corporate lobbyist lets that go to waste. And that's what happened with the biotech industry. Attached to the continuing resolution, what was called the biotech rider. And what this provision does is basically allow for an end run around the court system. So what's been happening is various public interest groups have been challenging U.S. Department of Agriculture approval of the planting of these novel GMO crops by the likes of Monsanto. And in some cases, courts have found that the USDA has essentially not done a proper review and found that the approval of these crops have been done illegally. Well, obviously, Monsanto doesn't like that. So this new provision requires USDA to essentially ignore the court's ruling that the agency's approval was done illegally. So that's why I called it shredding the Constitution, because we have a pretty basic concept in our democracy, which is that we have three branches of government, right? We have Congress, which makes the law, the executive branch carries out the law, and the judicial branch interprets the law. So, you know, where the judicial branch has said the executive branch hasn't done its job, it's an important check and balance on our governmental system. But because the lobbyists of the biotech industry didn't like that, they basically got their friends in Congress to say, that's okay, you know, USDA, you can just go ahead and ignore that court decision, and because we want to go ahead and plant our crops anyway.
Well, the person involved, or at least the point person in the Senate, a chair of the Agriculture Committee, is considered something of a liberal, is she not? Senator Barbara Mikulski.
Right. Actually, Senator Barbara Mikulski is head of the Appropriations Committee, which is the committee through which this budget bill sailed through. Now, it's true that her excuse for letting this go through was that this provision had reared its ugly head back last year when the House Appropriations Bill was making its way through that body, and also it came up during the Farm Bill debate. So this is a provision that's been around, and it just kind of got reattached to the continuing resolution, and Mikulski says, oh, it wasn't her fault. You know, she didn't want to have this happen, but of course she was under all kinds of pressure to get to ram this piece of legislation through. Again, because Congress is, you know, in such a broken state of affairs, that everything is done in this kind of emergency basis. And like I said, lobbyists, you know, are fully equipped to take advantage of this kind of crisis situation.
So basically, she just basically said, I just got buffaloed at the last minute. I mean, she had to know what was in the bill. It doesn't sound, not a convincing excuse.
No, it's not very convincing. I mean, but she felt the pressure. I mean, there, you know, over 300,000 people signed a petition brought by an organization called Food Democracy Now, based in Iowa, that was so outraged about this, they got their members to call the senator's office and the White House to try and stop this at the last minute, or at least to complain about it when it was too late. And Mikulski's office was so overrun with calls that she put out this very defensive statement saying, oh, you know, it wasn't my fault. Well, you know, look, the buck has to stop somewhere, and she could have shown some more leadership to not let that provision stand. Similarly, the White House could have, if it really wanted to, stopped it. Of course, again, because it was all done at the last minute, it would have been very difficult for the president to bring the government to a screeching halt over this. But he could have, in the alternative, put out a statement saying he didn't agree with this provision and wouldn't let it go through again.
You mean a signing statement?
Signing statement, exactly. Right. And he refused to do that. The only good news is the continuing resolution is only good for another 6 months, and so we'll see if our, you know, elected representatives and president, you know, do the right thing in not letting this type of provision attach to any other bill or, you know, stand alone.
Again, I'm speaking with Michelle Simon, who's a public health lawyer specializing in legal strategies to counter corporate tactics. She is president of Eat Drink Politics, a corporate watchdog consulting firm, and the author of Appetite for Profit, How the Food Industry Undermines Our Health and How to Fight Back. Her latest article at Food Safety News and the Huffington Post is Monsanto Teams Up with Congress to Shred the Constitution. Now, in terms of the other branch, the judiciary, there was, of course, a Supreme Court case very recently, wasn't there, involving Monsanto and GMO seeds, that Monsanto sued a farmer for illegally having these seeds, and apparently they're designed in such a way that they only operate work one planting only. Is that how it works? And but nature has its ways of altering the best laid plans, and you know the wind can blow the pollen, and the seeds will sprout up somewhere else. In this case, I believe he was collecting seeds at a granary, and they weren't specifically Monsanto seeds, but they had somehow bled into other seeds. I may not have the details correct here, so I better stop rambling and have you fill us in on what happened there.
Right. Well, that was a whole different situation, and but I believe this was someone who had planted Monsanto seeds and then was on the second life of the seed that Monsanto said, oh, well, you still have our patent for these seeds. So, you know, what the point is, though, that this company is trying to control this, the whole food supply, right? I mean, it's not just Monsanto. There are other seed companies that are, you know, the name of the game is to patent the seeds, to keep control over them so that a farmer that may want to plant seeds again the next year is subject to this kind of harassment. And so that's why people are so upset. Because what's more important than our seed supply? I mean, that's where all our food comes from. And these companies really want to control our entire food system. And they do it under the guise of, oh, we know we need this technology to help feed the world and so forth. When, of course, it's complete nonsense. I mean, we have plenty of food to feed the world. We just don't have the political will to spread it around in the most equitable way.
But isn't that the nature of what Monsanto is doing? It's not just monopolizing and arguing that these seeds have magical properties, but you have to keep paying for them as you go. So suffice it to say that Monsanto has a lot of clout, and it seems that its lobbying clout is pretty extraordinary if they were able to slip this bill in at the last minute in this must-pass continuing resolution to keep the government from shutting down. What's your understanding then of the array of lobbyists, and did they essentially catch the grassroots by surprise?
Yeah. Well, like I said, this provision was hanging around some other legislation earlier last year. And so, you know, but then they wait for the right opportunity. I mean, the thing is, these companies and lobbyists and trade groups that represent them are so powerful and have so much money to throw around that they have lobbyists, you know, in Washington, D.C., 24/7. So they just are there when the right opportunity comes along. So it's very hard for the advocacy groups to even, you know, respond when it's often too late. You know, we saw the power of the biotech industry teaming up with the junk food industry come down full force last fall in California, where we had the initiative on the ballot called Prop 37 to label genetically engineered food. I mean, that was an incredible display of lobbying power. $45 million spent by the combined efforts of the biotech, pesticide, and junk food industries to stop a measure that originally was polling 60% in favor. So, you know, it's very difficult to compete with that kind of lobbying power and money to spread your deception around, and that's exactly what happened.
Well, if in terms of heroes and villains, Barbara Mikulski folded and didn't stand up for the American people, it seems that the Montana Senator John Tester, who's actually a farmer, isn't he?
Yes.
He did. He tried to fight Monsanto.
Yes. Well, he did the best he could. I mean, you know, he was also on that committee and, you know, gave a passionate plea and tried to put an amendment in to the bill to try to reverse the biotech rider. But, of course, you know, he was in the minority and just got overrun with the whole steam train that was moving full speed ahead. But he has been a hero on behalf of farmers and the American people, for that matter, against the likes of Monsanto. It's just, obviously, we need more people on his side.
Well, there are, of course, agribusiness has taken over from the family farm. So what is the kind of political landscape there in terms of the power of agribusiness and the idea of organizing the family farm, farmers,
well,
I should say?
Well, I think you're pointing to a much larger problem, which is that we have you know, the family farm is fast going by the wayside, and all the data points to small farms, medium-sized farms becoming less and less, increasingly being consolidated or just taken over by larger agribusiness, you know, industries. And so, you know, this idea of the family farmer, this is a very, you know, kind of old-fashioned idea. Of course, it still exists here and there, but the agribusiness industry wants you to think of farming still as a family farm, when in fact most of agriculture in this country has been industrialized. And that means that, you know, the interests are to profit motive and go often to shareholder interests, where there are publicly traded companies, you know, at the helm. And that means that small farmers are getting the short end of the stick, and the American consumer, of course, we're not getting the types of varieties of truly healthy food that we need to thrive. Instead, it's basically whatever is cheap and convenient to, you know, monocrop. I mean, corn production in this country, for example, mostly doesn't even go to corn on the cob. It goes to feed animals, you know, increasing the Americans' meat-centered diet, which we know is not healthful. So there's all kinds of ways that big agribusiness has taken over the methods of production in this country that are bad for the environment, bad for small farmers, bad for, you know, animal cruelty, labor, our health, you name it.
Well, but you mentioned corn and how it's distorted our agriculture, because most of it's to feed animals in order to slaughter them for meat. But what doesn't end up that way seems to end up in high fructose corn syrup, which is the ubiquitous corporate food additive that's in just about everything on the supermarket shelves. And it is the leading, according to a number of very, very prominent medical researchers, it is probably the most direct cause of the obesity epidemic, particularly obesity among children.
Well, it's certainly one factor, and it's controversial as to whether how much of it has to do with high fructose corn syrup per se. There's no question that because of the, as you say, the ubiquitousness of that ingredient and its cheapness, you know, we've got supersized sodas and so forth. But in general, we have an agricultural system that is designed to pump out the cheapest ingredients that go into all kinds of processed food, animal feed, et cetera, and just to keep that engine going. And as opposed to looking at what we could be supporting, I mean, look, we don't even produce enough fruits and vegetables in this country to meet the current federal dietary guidelines for fruit and vegetable intake, right? I mean, right there, that tells you there's something seriously wrong. There's an extreme disconnect between our agricultural policy and what we know about just nutrition, common sense.
Well, just in closing then, Michelle Simon, Food Democracy Now! Apparently is gathering signatures demanding the president do the right thing. And you say this, the good news is this continuing resolution only goes for 6 months. Is that right?
Yes.
So there's another bite of the apple coming up. What should listeners do?
Well, I think they should absolutely get more informed about this and, you know, other issues like it. Support groups like Food Democracy Now!, another one that brings lawsuits, is Center for Food Safety. You know, really get involved with these types of organizations, get informed, and make sure, you know, when the next opportunity comes up to make your policymakers know, let your policymakers know that you're not happy with a decision that they're making. You know, we have to get involved. There's just no question about that. And that the only way, you know, policymakers listen is when they hear from us. So I think it really behooves all of us to make sure that, you know, we're connected with these groups and to be aware of when these opportunities come up to speak out.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Michelle Simon.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Again, I've been speaking with Michelle Simon, who's a public health lawyer specializing in legal strategies to counter corporate tactics. She is the president of Eat Drink Politics, a corporate watchdog consulting firm, and the author of Appetite for Profit, How the Food Industry Undermines Our Health and How to Fight Back. Her latest article at Food Safety News and the Huffington Post is Monsanto Teams Up with Congress to Shred the Constitution. And we're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking about how rivers of Canadian tar sands crude oil are flowing through the streets of Mayflower, Arkansas. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Damon Moglen, who is the Climate and Energy Program Director at Friends of the Earth and the former Global Warming Campaign Director at Greenpeace USA. He has worked on climate, energy, and nuclear issues for nearly 20 years with Greenpeace International, Physicians for Social Responsibility, and the Union of Concerned Scientists. Welcome to Background Briefing, Damon Moglen.
Good evening, Ian. Thank you for having me.
And it is a surreal and an extremely disturbing image to see rivers of oil flowing through the streets of Mayflower, Arkansas, a small town, but just outside of the capital, Little Rock. Well, not the capital, but the major city, Little Rock. But what's even more disturbing is to learn that this oil is the Canadian tar sands crude oil.
Well, yes, I think the images are just absolutely extraordinary to see this viscous, gunky tar sands oil flowing down people's driveway, down across sidewalks, down streets. It is really striking. And as you were saying, this is this unusual form of oil, tar sands oil, from Alberta, Canada. And this stuff is more difficult to transport, more difficult to clean up. And it's mixed in with chemicals in order to make it flow. So it also has cancer-causing chemicals mixed in with this terribly gunky oil substance.
So obviously there's a major debate going on for some, and has been going for some time, about the tar sands crude oil being shipped via the Keystone XL pipeline from the tar sands of Alberta, Canada, down to refineries in Texas. And many activists, Bill McKibben, for example, demonstrate in front of the White House to raise awareness of it. The initial State Department permission was withdrawn, and then they did another study. So bring us up to date on where things stand, because it's inescapable that at some point or other, even though the polls indicate there's a, I think, a 60+% support in this country, or 2/3 of the American people back the Keystone Pipeline. When they put two and two together with this oil spill in Arkansas and where this oil comes from, maybe those numbers will change.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think it's a foregone conclusion by any means that the Keystone XL pipeline is going to go ahead. I think that one of the things that this is going to prove is that this tar sands oil is indeed more difficult to transport through the pipes. It degrades the pipes, and that when and if we have spills, that it's more difficult to clean it up. So I think those are going to be emblazoned in people's minds as they think about this. But I think it's also going to become clear that, in fact, this oil is being piped through the United States, not for use in the United States, but in fact to be transported to refineries in the Texas Gulf, and then moved into international commerce. So in a sense, the United States is just being used as an area across which this oil is moved and then refined in order to make profits in Canada, but not in fact to be used in the United States. And I think increasingly U.S. people are going to be asking the question, why should we be making it possible for a Canadian oil company to be making billions of dollars in profits when this stuff is obviously dangerous to transport and dangerous and difficult to clean up?
So, Damon Moglen, again, the Climate and Energy Program Director at Friends of the Earth. As far as I know, this pipeline, I mean, in fact, I think it's pretty well established that this pipeline that's broken, the Pegasus pipeline, comes from the 1940s. I mean, this is an old pipeline. It's owned by Exxon. So where does it fit into the Keystone? Is this a part of the northern, or must be the southern part? So give us
Go ahead. Well, as you said, this is part of the so-called Pegasus pipeline, and this particular pipe runs from Patoka, Illinois, to the Texas Gulf Coast. And in Illinois, it in turn connects to one of the older Keystone, or may well connect to one of the older Keystone pipes, but nonetheless connects to a pipe that's bringing the oil from the Canadian tar sands. So this is a pipe, part of which, as you said, actually traces back to the 1940s. But in fact, ExxonMobil says that it's recently expanded and upgraded some parts of the pipe. But the bottom line is that this is one of the pipes that is indeed begun to carry this dirty and dangerous Canadian tar sands oil. And as you have said, there is, of course, this proposal to build a extraordinarily long pipeline directly from Alberta, Canada, across the center of the United States, down to the Gulf. That would be a pipeline, again, like this one, carrying only this Canadian tar sands oil into the international market out of the Gulf.
But my understanding is, Damon Moglen, that to even get the oil out of the tar sands up in Alberta, they use enormous amounts of water. And Bill McKibben's flown over that area, and he said it looks like Mordor. It's the end of the earth because right. There's just huge, huge lakes of this brackish water that's destroyed forever. And more and more, we're starting to realize that water is becoming a more and more valuable resource. But so all this water is being destroyed, but it's being used. They have to heat it up, tremendous temperatures, and through high pressure hoses, they essentially hose the tar out of hose the sand out of the tar, and then they take this gunk, and then they have to keep it hot. And then you're saying they have to mix in these chemicals, toxic chemicals, to make it flow through these pipes. So explain that process, let alone the fact that the environment up in Alberta is being destroyed water is being destroyed forever. And I don't know what the ratio of water to oil is, but apparently it's extraordinary. So every barrel of this gunk has already cost, the water for posterity. So,
well, that's right. I mean, this is, you've given a very good description. In fact, this is an extraordinarily environmentally damaging, carbon-producing, greenhouse gas-producing, an extraordinarily expensive way of extracting oil. You've got to clear-cut these beautiful virgin forests, and then you've got to literally pump extraordinarily superheated water into what amounts to a tarry sand, in order to extract this gunky tar substance out of the sand. And in so doing, you're using vast amounts of energy, which in turn are, of course, producing massive carbon emissions. It's been estimated that perhaps the production of tar sands oil is as much as three times the carbon emissions of other oil products. But in any case, you then got to get all this gunky water. You've got to extract the gunky oil out of the water. That water is then a pollutant itself. And now what you've got is this extremely abrasive, gunky kind of bitumen product to which you have to add chemicals in order to make it capable of flowing through a pipe. You've also got to, of course, put pressure in that pipe to make this substance flow. And these are all part of the problems of what happens if there is a spill. If there is a spill, you're dealing with this very heavy, thick, sticky oil product, which is mixed in with a whole witch's brew of chemicals, including, for example, benzene and others that we know are cancer-causing, in order to make it flow. And yet, once you're in the environment, you've got these chemicals and this terribly tarry substance. And in turn, if this tarry substance gets into the water, unlike other oils which float at the surface, the lighter oils, this stuff falls to the seabed or the riverbed or whatever, the lake bed. We have to be worried about Lake Conway in this case. And in turn, it becomes mixed in with the strata at the bottom of the water body, and it becomes extremely difficult and costly to clean it up. So a lot of different environmental issues and public health issues are posed by allowing this stuff to get out into the environment.
So tell us about what's the destruction so far in Mayflower, Arkansas, from this Exxon pipeline that's spilling.
That's right. I mean, just as in the case of the Exxon pipeline disaster in the Gulf, we've had a situation that the pipeline burst apparently started on Friday, and over the weekend, Exxon's estimates of how much oil was being released astronomically increased. In fact, between Saturday and Sunday, they estimated three times the original estimate, which, as you'll remember from the pipeline bursting in the Gulf, we had the oil burst in the Gulf that we had a similar situation with astronomical increases of how much oil. At this point, it's being estimated that as much as 12,000 barrels or over 500,000 gallons of this oil substance has escaped into the environment. The bottom line here is that because this is a buried pipe, we really don't know. And until they begin to excavate and we get a real sense of where the pipeline has burst, how much material has entered into the ground and perhaps into water, we really don't know exactly how much oil has escaped. But as you were saying earlier, what we do have are these extraordinary images of the oil running down people's driveways, across sidewalks, and down the street.
And you said Lake Conway is threatened.
One of the big concerns is that if the oil were to get into storm drains that in turn flowed into nearby Lake Conway, that there really would be a risk from the tar sands oil fouling Lake Conway, the natural resources of Lake Conway, and in turn, of course, that's a reservoir body, so potentially also water that could be used for other purposes.
And again, I'm speaking with Damon Moglen, who is the Climate and Energy Program Director at Friends of the Earth. We're talking about the surreal and hideous nature of what's going on in the town of Mayflower, Arkansas, where the viscous Canadian crude tar sand oil is flowing through the streets from a pipeline that's burst, belongs to Exxon Mobil, built in the 1940s, the pipeline, and it's spewing how many thousands of barrels so far that at least they've owned up to?
Well, we know already that according to Exxon, that 12,000 barrels, and of course the EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency, has labeled this a major spill, which is pretty scary.
But the pipeline accidents, just a brief history of the pipeline accidents in the United States, they've led to the deaths of 500 people and injured 4,000 since 1986. And last year there were 364 spills from U.S. pipelines, which released about 54,000 barrels of oil and refined products. So this is getting up there already, this Exxon spill.
Well, that's right. I mean, this is really a major spill, and I think that it taking place in a suburban community is just so shocking. But as you've pointed out, there are many spills every year, and that really transporting oil generally, but in particular this Canadian tar sands oil, is really a difficult and dangerous undertaking, and it's why so many people feel these pipelines should not exist. We should not be allowing the Canadians to be transporting this dirty and dangerous oil across the United States and just for pumping it into international commerce.
So let's talk about then the extent to which this is going to affect the Keystone XL pipeline debate and the activism that surrounded it, because there's some very passionate and dedicated people have been trying to stop this, and farmers whose land this pipeline will cross are concerned about the aquifers in Montana and across the states that will that this pipeline will cross are very concerned. But two-thirds, apparently, in a recent poll, two-thirds of the American people back the Keystone Pipeline, and obviously a lot of those are the drill baby drill people. So will this will be perhaps be a wake-up call and maybe change those numbers? But and of course, on the other side, belief in global warming is trending upwards, in spite of the global warming deniers that are out there in the Senate and on Fox News.
Well, yes, I think that this is a kind of remarkable and potentially game-changing moment. I think that there are a lot of claims, of course, about jobs, and in fact, what we know is that when we see 22 families evacuated from their homes, when we see entire communities put at risk, when we see something like Lake Conway potentially put at risk, we realize that the real cost here is quite evident, and that these pipelines are dangerous, and to be transporting dirty and dangerous Canadian tar sands oil, which we're not getting any benefit from, but which is really about Canadian oil companies' profits, it really doesn't make a lot of sense. And at the same time, I think there is a growing public understanding that the production of this oil is just devastating in terms of climate change impacts. and that there can really be no argument that allowing these pipelines to exist is not helping to encourage the development of Canadian tar sands, and thereby the U.S. government is really participating, if it chooses to give the go-aheads to Keystone, in encouraging further global warming in a way that's really unacceptable. So I think that this bill, dramatic as it is, really does come at a remarkable moment where people are demanding that the government learn the lesson of both kind of Superstorm Sandy, but also of the Gulf spill, and recognize that we've got to have a more reasonable program in terms of how we produce our energy, and that developing the most dirty and dangerous forms of oil shouldn't be a part of that.
Well, but I recall seeing those touchy-feely ads that the oil companies put out about how they're diversifying their energy portfolios and how concerned they are about the environment and our energy independence, etc. Exxon has been putting out ads saying that they're pushing the Keystone XL pipeline in the Canadian tar sands. So it may be that Canadians are profiting from it, but on the other hand, it seems that Exxon is also. At least they've got some kind of investment in it.
Well, that's right. I mean, I don't think, you know, Exxon made $44.9 billion in profits last year. So oil is big business. And I think you see just the vast sums of money that the oil companies spend in lobbying the government, in pumping money into candidacy. It goes without saying that the oil industry is a big political player. And for that very reason, they put the government under a lot of pressure to give the go-ahead to these dangerous pipelines. I think the counterforce here is that this administration has said that it recognizes that climate change is real and that they've got to get a grip on it and they've got to try to turn the situation around. So I think Keystone is a kind of decisive decision for Obama that you can't have it both ways. You've either got to decide to really move into a path where you stop these most dirty and dangerous forms of energy production, or you just accept that we're going to have catastrophic climate change in the future.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Damon Moglen.
Thank you very much. Good evening.
Good evening. Again, I've been speaking with Damon Moglen, who is the Climate and Energy Program Director at Friends of the Earth and the former Global Warming Campaign Director at Greenpeace USA. He's worked on climate, energy, and nuclear issues for nearly 20 years with Greenpeace International, Physicians for Social Responsibility, and the Union of Concerned Scientists. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon and assistant producer Nick Guarino. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow at 5 p.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Bye.